The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Over the last number of years, we've heard so much about the rise of injectables to combat obesity. Whether it's Ozempic by Novo Nordisk or Zepbound by Eli Lilly, the market for weight loss drugs has exploded in recent times. But where do these drugs come from? How do they come about? What led to the birth of Novo Nordisk's Ozempic, the drug that would push the Danish drug maker to new heights? Amy Donnellan is a columnist with Reuters, and she has charted the development of Ozempic in a new book which has a great title, Off the Scales, and she joins us now. Amy, good morning.
Very nice to be here. Thank you.
Now, what prompted your attraction to this particular theme and topic?
So I cover pharmaceuticals for Reuters. So I was writing about Novo Nordisk, which is the company, as you said, that makes Ozempic. And I was every quarter, you could see that their earnings were just surpassing anything that anyone had expected. But it wasn't obvious that this was like a weight loss story. And it wasn't until there was a day where I was sitting in my office and Novo Nordisk came out with research that said if you were taking these drugs, you were far less likely to go on dialysis, that you would need kidney dialysis. And there is a company that makes these kits, and that share price went down by multiples of billions. And then very shortly after that, my editor said, I want you to write a very large piece looking at the winners and losers of this. So winners being plastic surgeons, maybe retailers if people lose a lot of weight and buy clothes, and the losers being the food industry, drinks industry, anybody that relies on a steady stream of people with large appetites.
Now, what was driving this? Superficially, you could say type 2 diabetes, but of course that is due a lot to obesity. And then you go back a little bit further and say, why are people more obese now than they were a generation ago? And there are some obvious things, more sedentary work and so on, less exercise, more screen time. But the stats from America and from Europe are quite stark about the way we have grown.
This is true. So if you go back to like the 1950s, for example, obesity is not prevalent. It's fewer than 1 in 10 people suffer with obesity. And then that changes over the next few decades, but it's slow. And it really isn't until the 1980s and 1990s that you see a sort of explosion in people living with obesity. And as you said, there's a number of causes for that. Interestingly, the sedentary side, I read research when I was looking at this book. They have actually looked at people who were doing trades, so physical jobs, alongside people who, let's say, were doing office jobs and were doing these kind of sedentary roles. And what they found was obesity levels went up in tandem. So it wasn't necessary.
It doesn't mean, though, that the tradesperson was fatter than the other person.
No.
But the weight rise was parallel.
Which suggests that diet was very critical to all of this. And then if you look back, what happened in those decades is women went into work. Convenience food became very important in families. And then companies like Nestle and Kraft, they started making food that could last a long time on your shelf. It was laced with stabilizers and additives and all sorts of things that your body doesn't really know how to process. And they also contained this cocktail of sugar, fat and salt, which is highly addictive, doesn't fill you up. So people were eating more and more.
Now, the cost of all of this in the United States, obesity was costing the health services $150 billion and a further $66 billion in lost productivity. And proportionately, Europe was catching up.
Yes, absolutely. So it was definitely like it seemed like a U.S. story for a long time. And there was this trope about like, you know, in France, the fat Americans and things like that. But the truth is, obesity was rising all over the world. It's just that America was going faster than everybody
else. And more extreme. I mean, I remember going to Disney years ago and seeing all the wheelchairs outside Disneyland in Florida and thinking, that's very nice that, you know, Disneyland are thinking of the disabled people. They can have their own Disneyland wheelchair. It wasn't for disabled people. It was for people who were so overweight they couldn't make it around the park.
Yes, absolutely. And like today, the stats are very stark, even with these drugs. It's 70% of people are either overweight or living with obesity. So that means, and I've said this to scientists before, that means 30% of Americans are a healthy weight. And what they've said to me is, I think that's still too high. I think that 30% is even too high.
Now, the problem, I suppose, with all of this is that there are, and we all know them, the Slim Jims, the Greyhounds, who don't put on weight at all, no matter how much they consume, it would appear. And there is a genetic reason for that.
There is. So again, in the book, so the scientists who developed these drugs and many scientists I spoke to who have really looked at this disease, what they do is they go back to the Ice Age and they say that our ancestors, basically, if you survived, we're here today, our ancestors needed to survive brutally cold winters, famines. And how they did that was becoming very efficient at holding on to fat.
Yeah.
And so that is the bodies that we have now. So we can survive all sorts of terrible things like famines and cold. But it means if there is abundant food around, it's a terrible thing for our bodies because we're able to hold on to that.
And you can see this very notably in some African Americans because they were, it's feast or famine, that kind of thing. So for much of the year, they had to survive on stored fat. And then in the land of plenty, America, when people with that genetic makeup have so much food, as much as they want to, they never have the slim season, if you like.
Well, it's interesting. I didn't really look at that, actually. But what I did find when I spoke to people who specialized in, let's say, African-American healthcare in America, what they discussed actually was stress and the role of cortisol in weight, that actually the legacy of slavery, that the legacy of racism in America, that African and Black Americans are actually dealing with a huge amount of stress, and they find it very hard to lose weight as a result of that. There's a lot of research on that.
Now, the genetic element of this, there was one experiment which you describe in your book, which is extraordinary. A scientist who decided to tether two mice together, linking their bloodstreams, and one was a mouse that actually was slim, and the other was a mouse that tended to put on a few ounces, I suppose. What happened?
So this was the 1970s, and this was really pioneering work. So what he thought was that there could be something in the blood that was controlling the weight of the larger mouse and the thinner mouse, as you said. So he sewed these two mice together. They were therefore sharing a bloodstream, and it did show that the larger mouse's weight went down when it was sharing the bloodstream. So he was like, there has to be something in the blood. But it wasn't until the 90s that they identified that hormone as leptin, which was one of the controlling hormones.
Now, it's one thing to theorize about the science of it. It's another thing to get a treatment that would address diabetes type 2 and fundamentally the weight of those people who have diabetes type 2. So when did that particular vein of research start and who started it?
So there is a woman called Svetlana Moisov who comes from the former Yugoslavia. And so she came to America in the 1970s. And then she was working in Rockefeller University, working with hormones, very much trying to find a new treatment for type 2 diabetes.
And very much her own boss and treated in a very egalitarian way.
Very egalitarian.
In the Rockefeller.
Yes, absolutely. A very kind of flat structure. She had a mentor, Bruce Merrifield, who was obviously is on his way to winning a Nobel Prize himself. But she had great colleagues and peers that were all helping her with her research. And she became fascinated by the role of hormones and what they might do to regulate blood sugar, which is ultimately what diabetes is about. So she does her PhD. She gets on very well. And then she moves off to Mass General in Boston, which is one of the top research hubs in the world. And there she meets Joel Habner, who is this star endocrinologist. So an endocrinologist is somebody who specializes in the hormones that govern the body. And he has $1 million in funding. This is the 1980s. It's a vast amount of money. He has a lab that stretches the whole length of this building that he's in. He has all these very young, able scientists working with him. And he has also identified this hormone GLP-1 that he's very excited about. So Svetlana is this chemist. So she manages...
Now, but you point out that the chemists were seen at the bottom of the food chain.
Yes.
Compared to the endocrinologists who are doing, if you like, the medical work. But
this
of course,
this is
chemistry is at the heart of this.
Yes, it is. And you realize actually as the story progresses how important the chemists are to this story, because without them, you would never have stabilized GLP-1 in a way that actually could be absorbed in the body. But we won't run ahead. So yes, so she is working in Mass General. She is independently funded and she basically sets out to create GLP-1 in her lab and then she can test its properties. And once they do that, she tests it on the pancreas of a rat. So they take the pancreas out and they infuse it with GLP-1 and they see that the blood sugar of this rat reduces to just this perfect level, like a thermostat. And so that's quite magical because at the time, insulin was the only thing that was available. And insulin brings down your blood sugar very, very quickly. And the way it's been explained to me is that if it's off by even a fraction, that dose, it can lead to a coma. It can lead to all sorts of terrible things. So this is what she was trying to help and rectify. So she proves all these things. She gets these papers. She writes peer reviewed. Joel Habner is on many of the papers that she writes. And then she gets on with her life and her career, and she continues. She goes back to Rockefeller.
Now, talk to me about Novo Nordisk and how they became involved. You make the point that Novo Nordisk, you know, like every big drug company, they have a go. It's always a, if you like, a bet that they place on a particular chemical. This might be the one that'll cure Alzheimer's, that'll cure heart disease, or cure whatever is the disease they're preoccupied by. But many times they fail.
Yes. And they're like, I do in the book kind of compare them to gamblers, because what they do is, as you say, they put a number of bets on a number of different drugs. But then if there's any problems with those drugs early on, they tend to pull back. They don't want to waste any more money. So GLP-1, they got the licensing rights from Mass General for GLP-1 in the 90s, and they start working on a type 2 diabetes treatment. But what they keep finding is that the body flushes it out really quickly, so your kidneys get rid of it. Mm. So they can't stabilize it in the body. And as they're trying to do all these experiments, the executives in Novo Nordisk are saying, forget this. Insulin is our moneymaker. We don't need to try all these new things. But actually, what these scientists realize is that there is a very interesting side effect to these drugs, which is weight loss. And so they also go to their bosses and say, we think that we could actually create an obesity drug, that many of our patients actually with type 2 diabetes also are living with obesity. We could be a preventative company.
Now, they started a trial in 2013, a very substantial trial numerically, and by 2015, they had a result.
Yes, absolutely. So they did. They have basically showing the weight loss and just how exponential it was. But these things take years and years. It's actually one of the most interesting things that I found researching this book is just how long these things take. Mm. Years in terms of clinical trials. Clinical trials have to be held all over the world to make sure that, you know, different types of nationalities or races don't react differently to different drugs. But yes, they do. They eventually come up with Ozempic, and that is approved at the end of 2017, which is what we all know now.
I mean, the result of the trial in 2015, they start in 2013, 2015, they have the result, and it is dramatic.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much weight lost in all the people compared to the placebo versions. So they know they have something that works.
Yes.
So then they get approval finally, and this is good news, but you have to get traction. And it would seem to us, looking at it now, that it was an overnight success. But there was a lot of work in getting that traction. How did it come about?
So it was, as you say, it was because it was such an effective type 2 diabetes drug, it was doing very well for the company. It was one of their best-selling drugs. It very quickly became a blockbuster, which is over $1 billion of sales. But you're right, the weight loss elements of it, they hadn't actually yet marketed that. It was still a type 2 diabetes treatment. The weight loss was secondary. So they had to be careful how they told people about that. So in the summer of 2018, so the drug had been on the market for about 6 months, they came out with a commercial, a very, very catchy commercial. And for anyone who's been to the States, it is along to the song It's Magic from the 70s, Ozempic.
And a song by Pilot.
Yes. And it is like an earworm. It sticks in people's heads. And it's very unusual for Novo Nordisk to do this. This is the first time they have ever actually put out a very commercial, if as it were.
Yeah. Now, it had got kind of minor traction. There were people, I suppose, in Hollywood who were saying, you know, there's this stuff. If you've got a weight problem, you want to reduce it to make a movie or whatever it is, go to your doc and you might be able to get this. So there was a little bit of a... what would you call it?
A buzz.
A minor buzz.
Yes, absolutely. So definitely endocrinologists knew about the weight loss. They knew about it, as you said, from those very early trials. They were watching and getting very excited because they had patients that were on a previous obesity drug called Saxenda. And they thought, oh, this is even more weight loss. This will really help our patients. But as you said, there is a plastic surgeon in the book who starts getting phone calls in early 2018, as you say, from movie stars, producers saying, what about this diabetes drug? And he had never heard of it before. But yes, that is where the kind of trickle starts. But it is it's 3 years really until it goes into the mainstream.
Now, it's an injectable, obviously, and there are developments now that will provide a pill eventually from various manufacturers. But the problem at the beginning was when they were trying to bring this to market, that nausea was a problem, vomiting was a problem. And they solved that simply by saying, well, you don't give them the full whack at once.
That's it, exactly.
So that's wean them onto it.
Yes, so that's what they did. They gave the high dose at the beginning of these trials. And the way they describe it is everyone was vomiting, basically. That is because it's in your gut. It affects your gut. So there's all sorts of things that, you know, you do, a lot of people feel nauseous even still. So they start, you start off on a very low dose, and then what you're supposed to do is, this is supposed to be administered by your doctor, as in it's supposed, you're supposed to be prescribed it by your doctor, and your doctor is supposed to then watch you and see how you're coping with those gastric effects, because not everybody has them, but some people have them in quite an extreme way. So as you go up, the dose gets higher and the weight loss becomes more as well. So that is essentially what you're supposed to do, but it's not, unfortunately, what we're seeing people do now who get them on the internet.
Now, the effect on different people, is it always effective? Or, for example, we saw a story in one of the tabloids a couple of weeks ago, Prue Leith saying, my husband and I went on Ozempic or whichever one it was, Mounjaro, forget which one. He lost 3 stone. I lost 1 pound.
So you may not even be able to attribute that to the drugs. No, they don't work for everybody. There's about 15% of people who they don't really affect at all. Like, there's no weight loss, there's no side effects, there's nothing. And then there are other people who, as I said, have very, I would say, significant side effects to the point where they eventually come off them. So the most recent data that I've seen is over 50% of people come off them within a year. So that could be a number of things, that could be cost, but I do think from the people I've spoken to, I think the gastric side effects are definitely an element.
Now, there's also a story that, you know, once you're on it, if you want to maintain your weight at a low level, you're on it for life.
Yes. You kind of have to think about it like statins or insulin or any of those drugs that you just have to take for a long time. There's quite a lot of research now that's showing that people tend to revert back to the same weight. And then they also have the same kind of symptoms that they described living with obesity, which was, a lot of people talk about food noise, which is this internal chatter about being very hungry and always seeking out food. And what people say when they're on these drugs is that really quietens down, that they don't think about food very much throughout their day, and they can really just kind of get on with the things they need to do.
It's the biggest, I suppose, trial imaginable, because it's in the real world and there are so many millions of people now on these drugs. But the question of what it does to your palate, what it does, you lose your appetite really for gorging on food, but do you lose your taste for food?
So some people do feel kind of repulsed by food. I've definitely spoken to people who just, you know, they see food on a table and they just feel like almost that feeling of, if you're really, really, really full and then somebody put a plate and food in front of you, that's kind of how they feel. Some people, just their appetite is just reduced an awful lot, to the point, like one doctor described it as like living like a skinny person, where you eat small amounts. You're not thinking, as I said, about food that much. And then there are some people who actually do, unfortunately, vomit quite a lot. It's just a reaction to the drug. It's just obviously really unsettles their stomach. And it does calm down in lots of people as well.
There are some stories that people's cravings for other things like drugs or alcohol or nicotine even are dimmed by Ozempic. Is there any truth in that?
Yeah, so that seems to be, there's certainly lots of anecdotes of people, and I've spoken to many that were included in the book. So one man I spoke to had this, you know, insatiable appetite for Diet Coke. So he'd drink gallons of Diet Coke, and then basically he goes on these drugs and he looks in his fridge and goes, that bottle of Diet Coke's been there for ages. I haven't even drank any. Wine is another one. Some people say that they just don't have any appetite for wine. I met Matt Cooper recently, who talked about only being able to really stomach one pint now. He just doesn't really want much alcohol. So yeah, it does seem to certainly affect your appetite. And a lot of people I spoke to as well seem to crave very healthy food. So if you think about these drugs, they're actually helping people lose weight, but also giving them an appetite for things that they should be eating, which I think is kind of incredible. So salmon, vegetables, and one man I spoke to said that sugar, he just cannot tolerate sugar. It makes him feel really unwell.
So the future, I mentioned Ozempic when it came out first, an injectable, but there are promises of maybe a daily or weekly pill that will do the same job.
That's it, yeah.
Where are we going with all of this?
So at the moment in the US, Novo Nordisk has got approval to sell this oral Wegovy, which is the obesity medication. So you take this tablet daily. It does have the same side effects as the injection. So I think where we're going is, it does seem like people want a pill rather than injection. There's actually a fairly decent minority of people who are afraid of needles and really don't like the idea of taking them in perpetuity. So a tablet seems to be the future, and a tablet that has fewer side effects. And you can see that Eli Lilly, which is the company that makes Mounjaro and Zepbound, they are very much trying to create a different type of pill. Novo Nordisk is also trying to create all sorts of different pills. And then there's so many other pharmaceutical companies that are also trying to muscle in on this sector.
Because GLP-1, I mean, it's there. It's how you manufacture it, I suppose, how you formulate it makes your drug different to the one next door.
It's true, because Eli Lilly's version is GLP-1 plus another hormone. And there's different hormones people are working on. One is called amylin. It's just another gut hormone. So they're just trying to find different mixtures of these types of hormones to see what's the one that people tolerate the best and gives, I suppose, you know, competitive weight loss.
Now, for this to be affordable for many people, they'd have to wait for generics. How far away are generics in terms of the patentable nature of these drugs?
So it depends on what country you're in. So for the US, 2031 is when the patent for semaglutide, which is like the secret sauce of Ozempic and Wegovy. So that runs out in 2031. Europe is a similar time. India, actually, this year, the patent runs out. So they're actually going to start to see generics now. And the generics seem to be very cheap, like $100 a month kind of cheap. In America, it's about $500 is one of the levels you can pay for it.
Well, it's an extraordinary story and brilliantly told in a book called Off the Scales, The Inside Story of Ozempic and the Race to Cure Obesity. Its author is Amy Donnellan. And Amy, thank you very much for joining us on the programme today.
Thanks very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.